pride is such an important part of Portland life, as people have been letting me know since I started with you. So, I don't know if you remember last Father's Day, I did something with Noah and the Ark, right? Oh, you don't remember. That's okay. You've all heard this story of Noah from the Bible about how God decided to destroy the world with a flood, destroy it so he could make it clean and good again. God told Noah to build an ark and fill it with pairs of animals and then made it rain for 40 days and 40 nights. And you remember, of course, last year when I asked you to sing that silly Bible camp song about the floody, floody and the arky, arky? Some of you remember that, right? Don't worry, we always remember embarrassment. But don't worry, I'm not going to ask you to sing a silly song every Father's Day service. Okay, so things finally dry out. Noah comes out with his family and his sons' families and all those critters, and God speaks of the rainbow in the sky as if it were his own weapon of war, the bow and arrow kind of bow. And he turns it away from us, right? And says to Noah, "This is the sign of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that's upon the earth." And now he sends this flesh off to populate the earth again, which flesh loves to do, blessing it with the same way that he'd blessed Adam and Eve. Be fruitful and multiply. Well, now let's hear how Noah did when his turn came to distribute blessings and curses. The sons of Noah who went forth from the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was peopled. Noah was the first tiller of the soil. Of course, if you've read your Bible from the beginning, you'll remember that Adam was forced to till the soil for food after being kicked out of the Garden of Eden, where it all just grew on trees. So Noah is really the first tiller of this new earth after the flood. And what does this first tiller till? He planted a vineyard, and he drank of the wine and became drunk, and lay naked in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. Then Shem and Japheth took a cloak, laid it upon their shoulders, and walked backwards and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned away, and they did not see their father's nakedness. When Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan. A slave of slaves shall he be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed by the Lord, my God, be Shem, and let Canaan be his slave. God, enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his slave." After the flood, Noah lived 350 years. All the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. After passing out nude, does he express shame or embarrassment? No. He lashes out in rage, directing the brunt of it not at his son, but at his grandson. So now he becomes the world's first grumpy old man. Not just the Bible's archy builder, but also its first archy bunker. You all remember All in the Family on TV? Even you younger members, maybe from reruns? That would make Ham the Bible's meathead, of course. But why ever should Grandpa's curse fall on little Canaan? What's going on here? Well, let's ponder this after we sing a very serious song, "Those Were the Days," from All in the Family. And our choir is going to help. This choir, by the way, emerged so quickly, just so quickly, almost out of the blue. And without, I forgot to inform the choir about my needs for this Sunday. And the choir, in the person of Linda Jo, contacted me and said, "Do you need us to do this? Do you need us to do that?" "Oh, yeah." "That would be nice. So are you going to help lead Those Were the Days?"
"Sure."
"Okay."
"Or we just have the choir sing from..."
"From their seats, okay. Yeah, as you prefer." Okay. And those were the days. Boy, the way Glenn Miller played songs that made the hit parade.
his weight. Gee, I'm a Sal Rand great. Those were the days. And you know you were then. Girls were girls and men were men. Mystery could use a man like Herbert Hoover again. People seem to be content. $50 paid the rent. Freaks were in a circus tent.
I'm glad not too many people. Thank you. I'm glad not too many people try to shriek like Edith, because that could really hurt your throat. The great Gene Stapleton. So God has hung his bow up in the sky, while down below here, this is where the bowstring goes, on earth, he gives us slack. He won't be so quick to curse and destroy, but he's promised us a little patience in the future. This is the sign of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is upon the earth. Look at this bow and remember, but you don't have to fear my arrows raining down on you at the drop of a hat. However, Noah has dropped his pants, or maybe it was some kind of a loincloth. We don't know exactly, but we do have a pretty good idea of why it happened. He planted a vineyard, and he drank of the wine, and became drunk, and lay uncovered in his tent. That's all the scripture has to say about the wine itself, but rabbis and other storytellers tried to explain some more. In their Agadah, or extra-biblical legends, they tell us that Adam, the first real agriculturalist, had taken a grapevine along with him when he and Eve were kicked out of the garden. In fact, grapes were the original forbidden fruit they'd eaten, not apples. Those didn't even exist. They tasted some of them, some that had fermented, and they found they liked it. So why not steal a vine on the way out, since they were already in so much trouble anyway? Generations later, Noah brought several cuttings from that original grape stock along with him on the ark, the fruit of paradise. Do you remember who had tempted Adam and Eve to taste those grapes the first time? Who? Yeah. Can you guess who helps Noah plant the first vineyard? Same guy. The rabbis tell us that Satan happened to be passing by just as Noah was transplanting the cuttings. He asked Noah, "What is it that you're planting there?" Noah answered, "A vineyard." Now Satan asks him, "What are the qualities of the fruit that it produces?" And Noah replies that the fruit it bears is sweet, whether it is fresh or dry. And it yields wine that rejoiceth the heart of man. So Satan makes a proposition. Let's go into a partnership in this business of planting a vineyard. And Noah agrees, thinking that he's found another cool friend, just like God. Business agreements then as now need to be sealed with a proper ceremony. So since it's still a bit too early to open a bottle of wine and make a toast to the venture's success, Satan offers an animal sacrifice, the sort of thing that would have seemed proper in the ancient world. First, he, quote, slaughtered a lamb, and then in succession, a lion, a pig, and a monkey, and made the blood of each flow under the vine. Then he explained to Noah what the qualities of wine are. Before man drinks of it, he is innocent as a lamb. If he drinks moderately, he feels strong as a lion. If he drinks more of it than he can bear, he resembles the pig. And if he drinks to the point of intoxication, then he behaves like a monkey. He dances around, sings, talks obscenely, and knows not what he is doing. Well, many years ago, I worked at a winemaking equipment supply store. One day, a customer came in to buy a basic setup for fermenting a few gallons of Pinot Noir. I was starting to ring up his purchase when he asked, "So, if I mix up a batch this morning, can I drink it this afternoon?" I'll never forget the look on his face when I explained that it would take several months at least and would be much better after 2 years. 2 years! But through the power of Satan's offering, Noah's grapes ripen and the first wine is ready to drink in just one day. I should have known that trick. So he's able to enjoy his Pinot Noir without exercising any of that patience that he had cultivated earlier, building that ark, gathering the animals, waiting out the storm, and those long weeks until the waters receded. We've also heard that he waited until he was 500 years old before begetting his three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Maybe now he feels like he's done enough waiting for other people and enough work. So now Dad's going to do something for himself. He goes from lamb to lion to pig to monkey, all in the course of the world's first bender. And then, thoroughly bent, he throws off his clothes, passes out in his tent. And who should walk in on him but Ham? He must have been walking forward when he walked in. That's how you usually walk when you want to see where you're going. So what did Ham see when he walked into Noah's tent? There was Dad, naked. Yeah, but was that all there was to it? The Bible doesn't give us any details, but the rabbis do. They tell us that when Ham went out to tell his brothers what he'd seen in the tent, he took his time coming to the point. He started by making a reference to Adam and to Cain and Abel. The first man had but two sons, and one slew the other. This man, Noah, has three sons, yet he desires to beget a fourth besides. Now, what would have indicated to Ham that his father desired a fourth son when he saw his old man sleeping naked? Oh, yeah, that. Who would disagree that that's something most kids wouldn't want to see? Walking in on Dad who dreams of getting it on even while he's sleeping one off. Most anyone would walk right out. Forwards, backwards, sideways, anyway, who cares? Just so it's out and fast. But the rabbis tell us that that's precisely what Ham did not do. They say he didn't leave until he had attempted to, quote, perform an operation upon his father designed to prevent procreation. So what operation do they mean? Oh yeah, that. And all of this, so many years before Sigmund Freud started to describe all the fears and feelings in order to explain some of the problems that can arise between parents and children. Whether he just walked in and walked out like the Bible says, or stayed and tried to do something awful to Noah like the old rabbis tell us, the end result for Ham was catastrophic. Or I should say that it was catastrophic for Ham's own son, Canaan. Maybe Noah was lashing out at his adult son's fatherhood, like he thought Ham had done to him, by cursing his grandson. The curse comes in two parts. The first part goes, "Cursed be Canaan, a slave of slaves shall he be to his brothers." That's pretty harsh. The second part goes like this, "Blessed by the Lord my God be Shem, and let Canaan be his slave." That's even harsher, the way it confers a blessing on two branches of the family, right along with a curse on the third. It contorts a blessing into a curse, which is a particularly ugly thing to do. It should be no less painful for his brothers than it is for Ham when their father's words strike future generations. Who wants to receive blessings from another being cursed? Who wants that? And I guess the real question is, who will accept them? And the answer is, most people. Yeah, afraid so. There'll be a time to talk about this after the service for those who can stay when our Black Lives UU groups meet to talk. Right? When we read further into the Bible, we see how this curse means one branch of Canaan's lineage, the Canaanites, are to be harassed and eventually displaced from their land by the coming of the Hebrews. On this level, Canaan stands in for some issues that are national and political rather than familial and personal. The Bible doesn't try to tell us that Canaanites are somehow more naturally suited to be slaves than others, but Canaan is also the father of Cush and the people called Cushites, about whom the old rabbis had a mouthful to say. Here's how they describe the Cushites. They have red eyes because Ham looked upon the nakedness of his father. They have misshapen lips because Ham spoke with his lips to his brothers about the unseemly condition of his father. They have twisted curly hair because Ham turned and twisted his head round to see the nakedness of his father. And they go about naked because Ham did not cover the nakedness of his father. Thus he was requited, for it is the way of God to mete out punishment measure for measure. Such non-scriptural teachings were later put to use by so-called Christian thinkers to justify the enslavement of Black Africans. It was a useful ideology for American preachers in the slave states and persisted in some denominations long after slavery was abolished. As late as 1978, for one distinctly American church. This very physical, the very physical features of the slaves were the result of Noah's curse and referred back to Ham's actions. Thicker lips, curlier hair, and the supposed condition of nakedness in which they lived before receiving the blessings of clothing and shackles from the offspring of Japheth and Shem. That's what they got. Clothing, shackles, and the Bible. Oh yeah, that. God, who last spoke when he made what sounded like a lasting promise to the whole of the human family, seems to have fallen silent during Noah's drunken outburst. Some might say that he's playing the role of an enabler. Readers of the Bible assume God's tacit approval for his old friend's behavior. But maybe there's another way to read God's silence in these moments. God says nothing while Noah curses. Who is he to criticize after his own anger nearly wrecked the world? Noah learned what God had taught him. Like father, like son, maybe. Yeah, maybe God's ashamed. The story can point us past the dynamics of our own nuclear or extended families. It can lead us to ponder how national and international fathers or mothers make claims on our lives, offering the blessings of support and protection if and only if we agree not to see and above all not to tell our sisters and brothers the truth we know about them. Ham was punished for the truth, remember. Not for lying. Political parties or administrations are known to act like this. Churches or other religious families often do the same thing. Reading the story in this way, Noah can be taken to represent human power and its unwillingness to be seen for what it is behind the scenes that it creates. Kind of like that good old Wizard of Oz, but meaner. The story can lead us in so many directions. The story of Noah is rich, complex, and oceanic. We'll never exhaust its many meanings because they'll continue to rise and spill over and recede like tides or floodwaters, always changing with the times. But I'd like to say just a bit more today before Father's Day comes next week, along with Portland Pride Day, and the first day of summer after an unusually long and watery winter. after the flood, after all of his efforts to preserve his family and the beasts, Noah began to behave like one himself. Lion, pig, monkey, lamb, until finally lashing out at Ham. Still drunk, I suppose. I don't think the rabbis present convincing evidence that Ham tried to cut anything off of Noah, but Noah cut off his son and grandson and a whole limb of the human family tree for no good reason at all. So Ham saw him naked. So what? Maybe Ham saw that Noah, the first human being who ever tried to make the world clean and great again, was not as big as he thought he was before. He saw that asleep and vulnerable, Noah was only as big as he was, no bigger than Ham, maybe even a little smaller. That happens. There's no reason to believe that Ham couldn't keep what he'd seen in perspective. But Noah has lost his own perspective completely. He can't bear to have been seen. God, enlarge Japheth, he yells, as he curses Ham and Canaan to be small, to be a lesser man than his brothers. Those same brothers Ham had warned so they could walk backwards to cover the old man, so they wouldn't have to see him for what he is. Maybe he regrets he told him. Well, turning from Noah back to good old Archie Bunker, we often saw him scorn certain family members as lesser, smaller people. Sometimes he threatened to cast them out. But the title of that old TV show was not some in the family. It was all in the family. And that was the beauty of it, and the reason it found such a central place in American viewing habits. That show loved all of its characters. Even as it poked fun at them, it honored them. It was about liberals and conservatives living with each other, not against each other. Whoever imagined herself, but especially himself, as bigger and better than the other guys was quickly due for some reduction, some deflation, some chastening and humbling. The best comedy, like the best religion, is always based on love. The greatest comedians love the people they tease, including people on the other political side from theirs, including their parents, including themselves. Those who burn with real scorn or hatred for themselves or others may hold our interest for a while, the way we'd watch a house on fire. But they don't become part of our own family in the way that Lily Tomlin does, or Eddie Izzard, Ellen DeGeneres, or now Aziz Ansari. When you till the soil of this earth, you get dirty sometimes. You might even get teased as a pig or a monkey. But what is soiled can be made clean. Most parents know this about children. I think one might be getting clean now. Most parents know this about children. Most children eventually learn this about their parents. I hope we can all do our best while we still have time. The story of Noah ends by telling us that after the flood, Noah lived 350 years. All the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. 950 years. Enough time to get things sorted with his children and grandchildren. I hope that he did, and finally hung up his own bow and his big old arrows, and I hope that they did too. And we can do the same with ours. Now, I invite you to take a few moments as you call out, as you call your own fathers to mind. Lions, lambs, monkeys, men. When you're ready, please say his name aloud and the number of years that he lived or has been alive so far. Very simple, just the name and the years. I'll start with my own. Chiro Moro.